You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Well, the Senate, Bernie actually voted for it, for the budget. The Senate passed a budget with 67 votes, which was more than the 60 necessary to overcome a Republican filibuster. It's interesting, if you look at the states where both members of the Senate voted against them, it kind of starts in Mississippi and Alabama, loops across, and just goes right straight up the middle of the country. It's the same states, basically, that are not allowing their people to have their own tax dollars back from Washington, D.C. in the form of Medicare expansion, which is very, very strange. So, meanwhile, Paul Ryan, who helped cut this deal, along with Patty Murray and you know, a group of 10 other members of the, I think it's 10, maybe it's more than that, members of the House and Senate. Bernie was on the committee. Paul Ryan is now saying, or said day before yesterday on TV, that they're trying to figure out what they're going to try to extract from Democrats in exchange for raising the debt ceiling. Now, this should be entertaining. See, Edmund Wright, conservative commentator, contributor to Breitbart and the American Thinker, the author of the book WTF, How Karl Rove and the Establishment Lost Again. His website, CEdmundWright.com, and you can find a link to it over at TomHartman.com. See, Edmund Wright, welcome back to the program.
Glad to be back, Tom. Did I see you on the military channel talking about the Kennedy assassination over the weekend?
It may well have been. NBC did an hour-long special on the Kennedy assassination. I think it's called The Men Who Killed the President, that has been playing on the Discover Channel for about 5 years. About every month or every other month they play it. It's me and Lamar Waldron. We wrote a book on the topic.
Yeah, well, it popped up on the military channel over the weekend.
Ha! How about that? Let's see, it's a pretty good documentary.
Irritated me, so I don't know if that's good or bad.
It what?
You didn't say a thing in that documentary that upset me, so I don't know if that's good or bad.
Well, I think that we all have some serious questions about who killed Jack Kennedy, although I think that Lamar and I have come pretty close to figuring it out, but that's a whole other topic.
Yep.
So you're of the opinion that the Republicans are probably not going to hold the Democrats hostage over the debt ceiling. Do I have that right?
Well, yeah, first of all, I wouldn't call it holding hostage, but actually, I think John Boehner and Mitch McConnell and the boys will fall right in line with what you want on the debt limit as well. You know, the Republican establishment, and this speaks to my book, which you plugged, I appreciate that, but it speaks to the Civil War inside the Republican Party and the conservative movement, and the establishment is always, you know, caving in because of the fear of a government shutdown. And always saying, but we'll fight harder the next time, and they rarely do. Ted Cruz forced their hand a little bit about 10 weeks ago, but that was an abnormal situation. So actually, Tom, I wish I could say your fears are founded. I don't think they are.
Well, what would the issues be? I mean, if the Republican Party is going to win elections with anything other than subterfuge or lies, I mean, you know, without going to single issues, I mean, historically what they've done is, you know, oh my God, you know, they're coming to get your guns, let's hold a special election and throw two Democratic senators out in Colorado kind of thing, and just appeal to a very thin slice of the electorate. And in many ways, the Republican Party has been able to win elections. Where they've been able to win elections is by taking the misogynist vote, you know, the anti-abortion, anti-woman vote, the gun vote, the fundamentalist Christian vote. You know, they take these individual slices and throw them together. I mean, the Democrats do the same thing. It's just that their slices are different. But there's a serious conversation in the Republican Party about how do we appeal to working class Americans, because the economy really sucks and working class Americans are really taking a hit, as are, you know, pretty much everybody except the top 10%. And so how do we appeal to these folks? What policies do we have? I mean, you know, during the Reagan era, it was, you know, we're going to cut everybody's taxes. Well, that not only didn't work, it actually, you know, we went from four decades of 3.3% GDP growth to now we've had three decades of 2.7% average GDP growth. It actually hurt this country. We went from continuously rising wages on working people, literally from 1793 until 1980, to flat, in fact, falling wages on working people. So 30 years of Reaganomics and tax cuts haven't worked. What are the Republicans going to sell that might actually benefit working people? It seems like everything in their quiver either is a gift to a special interest group, or and that special interest group is never the American middle class. And that's the biggest special interest group, I'd say, on the Democratic Party side, which is makes it easier for them to win elections. Or it's a gift to the billionaires.
Well, I don't think they're trying to win the elections on the back of billionaires. There's not that many of them that vote. Besides which, you know, things have turned. It's the Democrat Party that's the party of Wall Street now more than the Republican Party. But, gosh, Tom, there was a lot there, going back to Reaganomics and everything. I'm not sure the Reagan tax cuts didn't work. The federal government...
they tripled the national debt. You give me a $3 trillion credit card,
I'll show you what it looks like to live large. There's two sides to a debt. There's income and there's outgo.
He doubled national spending in 8 years, too, discretionary spending.
Yeah, he had a Democrat Congress, and he's not a hero on spending with what he was able to accomplish.
Every single one of those budgets was a budget that Reagan approved or proposed.
No, I agree, but they were Democrat budgets that he approved.
No, they were Reagan budgets that he was approving.
Well, he didn't have the House.
Reagan who proposed Star Wars, which sucked up a trillion of it.
Yeah, he did propose Star Wars, but let me ask you a question. Let me just ask you a question here, because you're a smart guy. How in the world can the Republican House hold Barack Obama hostage, and yet when Reagan had a Democrat House, it was a Reagan budget? I mean, seems like you're kind of playing both sides of the street there, Tom.
Well, no, I'd say things have changed a lot since the 1980s.
Yeah, but
Reagan, how many?
The Constitution hadn't. The separation of powers has not.
Actually, it has. The Democrats were not filibustering every piece of legislation during the Reagan administration. In fact, Reagan had, two filibusters in his entire 8 years?
Last week, anyway, 2 weeks ago, so don't worry about it.
Well, that's only for nominees and for judicial appointments.
Yeah,
it's not for laws.
Right.
I'm curious, what is the policy? You know, what is the law that Republicans want to pass that's actually going to help the middle class?
Well, the main thing that they want to do is they want to roll back Obamacare, and that's what 2014 will be about.
How does that help the middle class to not have health insurance?
It doesn't help the middle class to not have health insurance. It helps the middle class not to have this disastrous government-run health insurance program.
Well, it's not government run. This is private insurance companies.
Everything about it is government mandate. Yes, they mandate it with private companies. And by the way, I'm very critical of these private companies who sign up for this crony care kind of situation that's now backfiring on them. So there's
a
little
bit Obamacare has, it starts at the beginning of this year in the final and big way. It's not responsible for the last 32 years of a crappy economy and flat wages.
No, so Obamacare is not. But
what do Republicans have to offer as opposed to take? So they want to take away Obamacare. That's not offering something. What do Republicans have to? Democrats want to extend unemployment insurance. They want to increase spending on infrastructure projects. They want to put America back to work.
Like the stimulus did, where Obama admitted there weren't as many shovel-ready jobs as he thought.
Yeah, but it did work. It took us from 700,000 jobs a month that we were losing to zero.
Well, except that we now have 92 million unemployed adults, and because of the way we count, the percentage is 7.3 or whatever it is, but it's 92 million unemployed adults, and that's not...
Well, you're counting all the people who choose to be stay-at-home housewives students in college.
That number should be probably 65 or 70 million, not 92 million.
10.9 is the official number, 10.9 million. But again, what would you do about that? I mean, Republicans want to cut unemployment benefits for those people. What would you do?
Well, I don't think unemployment benefits are a long-term solution.
Okay, so there's nothing to do.
Nothing you're going to like.
Okay. C. Edmund Wright, his website, cedmundwright.com. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And his book is WTF, How Karl Rove and the Establishment Lost Again. Be right back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Nate Sweet is on the line with us. Whoops, I got to push the right button here, don't I? Hey, Nate, how you doing?
Hey, how's it going, Tom?
Good. So we're going to start out with a solo rant about that kind of encapsulates, I think, the debate I just had with C. Edmund Wright, where I kept saying, what is the positive vision that the Republicans
have for the middle class, for the working people. And he was like, well, I don't know.
Yeah, I think that's the response we'll probably get from our panel, but with a few more talking points thrown in. We're going to have Neil and Huey Newsom, both veterans of the politics panel, on our panel today. And I will actually be on it as well as the twin progressive voice with you. So that should be interesting. But what I think is interesting is the last time I think any Republican president at all adopted Democratic ideals. I think most people would say it's probably the most successful Republican president of the 20th century, and that was, you know, Dwight D. Eisenhower. And he remains to this day a remarkably popular president among wide portions of the American population. And my grandparents, who were, you know, I think Eisenhower Republicans, always respected him, but they've since become Democrats. So I think that tells you a lot about what Eisenhower was.
Well, I got to play something for you, Nate. This is in the election of 1940. It was Franklin Roosevelt running for his third term versus Wendell Willkie, who was the Republican. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Listen to this. This is Wendell Willkie, the Republican, running against FDR, talking about his platform. Here he is.
I believe that the forces of free enterprise must be regulated. I'm opposed to business monopoly. I believe in the right of collective bargaining by labor without any interference and full protection of that obvious right. I believe in minimum standards for wages and maximum standards for hours, and I believe that such standards should constantly improve. I'm in favor of the regulation of interstate utilities, of banking, of the security markets. I believe in federal pensions, in adequate old age benefits, and in unemployment allowances.
Now, that was the Republican candidate for president in 1940 articulating his platform.
Well, you know, I know one of my takes on this is, you know, I think Republicans at that time were actually conservative Republicans. They weren't radical ideologues. And I think there's a very strong conservative argument in favor of the social safety net because it reduces the possibility of social upheaval. You know, Otto von Bismarck was the first Western European leader ever to propose a national health care system because he thought it would undercut the...
In the 1890s.
Right. He thought it would undercut the socialists.
And successfully, he didn't just propose it. He put it into place.
Right. And it worked.
And it prevented a Bolshevik revolution in Germany. And what Wendell Willkie was saying was basically the official conservative position, which is keep things as they are.
Oh, yeah. Well, I guess Roosevelt already put them into place. He's just preserving what Roosevelt
I mean, that's this is the definition of conservatism is keep things as they are. And so he just went through the list of what FDR had accomplished and said, that's all fine with me.
It's kind of a nice campaign platform. Doesn't take
much thought. Yeah, yeah. So anyhow, we're going to have that debate. And then we're going to have a conversation as the Great Minds. Tim Carpenter is going to.
Right. It's going to be a pretty special Great Minds. Tim is the National Director for the Progressive Democrats of America. He's not doing too hot right now. So we're going to get some thoughts of him.
He's dying of cancer is what's going on.
Right.
And so we're going to talk about that, and we're going to talk about PD America.
Yeah, we're going to thoughts on, you know, mortality in America and, you know, the future of the progressive movement with the Democratic Party.
If you could give Tim a call and just discuss some of the questions with him before we put this thing together, would you please?
Yeah, we'll do that. Absolutely.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
All right, thanks.
I'll see you tonight.
Bye.
It's going to be a great show tonight, so be sure and tune in. The Big Picture. We'll be right back. Okay, welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 20 minutes past the hour. I want to step into the Wayback Machine here. I've got a whole bunch of, it's the end of the year. I was going through my old clip library, things that I've cut out for various shows, and there's just like things that you've got to hear. I mean, things that you just have to hear. This, let me start out, and I just played this for Nate, the producer for our TV show. In 1940, the presidential election, the Democrat was Franklin Roosevelt running for his third term. Or was it his fourth term? No, it would have been his third term. Now, wait a minute. 32, 36, 40. Yeah, third term, right? Anyway, FDR was running against Wendell Willkie. Wendell Willkie was the Republican. So, hey, you know, Wendell Willkie's the Republican. He must be in favor of busting unions, right? I mean, that's what Republicans are in favor of, right? He must be in favor of ending Social Security. He must be in favor of deregulating Wall Street. He must be in favor of deregulating the banks. He must be, I mean, these have come to be the Republican positions. What you have to understand, though, is that Wendell Willkie was an actual conservative Republican. And back in 1940, conservative meant, because these guys today, they're not conservatives, they're radicals. They're revolutionaries. They want to blow up the established order. That is not conservative. Conservative is keep things the way they are. Yes, you can make change, but you do it slowly and gradually. So we're going to keep things the way they are. So in 1940, this is how things were. And Wendell Willkie was saying, let's just keep things the way they are. Here is the president, the nominee, the Republican Party's nominee for president in 1940, Wendell Willkie.
I believe that the forces of free enterprise must be regulated. I'm opposed to business monopolies.
Oops.
I believe in the right of collective bargaining by labor without any interference and full protection of that obvious right.
Protection?
I believe in minimum standards for wages and maximum standards for hours. And I believe that such standards should constantly improve. I'm in favor of the regulation of interstate utilities, of banking, of the security markets. I believe in federal pensions, in adequate old age benefits, and in unemployment allowances.
Are you, now, today's Republicans want to cut unemployment. In fact, they just succeeded. And the budget that was just passed is, you know, is going to cause 1.2 million people to lose their unemployment benefits 3 days after Christmas. This was Paul Ryan's gift to America. But Republicans weren't always that crazy. They weren't always that crazy. In fact, you had progressives. Now, you go back to the big progressive movement, like in 1910, 1912, 1908, 1909, or 1907, I guess it was when the Tillman Act was passed, which made it illegal for politicians to take money from corporations. So here's William Jennings Bryan in the election of 1912.
The Republican leaders have attempted to raise a false issue and have accused the laboring men of lack of respect for the court.
The Republican leaders have tried to raise this false issue. He goes on. It's not a very good recording, so I'm not going to play a lot of it. But that was William Jennings Bryan. William Jennings Bryan, however, did not win the election. And so, as if you ever watched the Beverly Hillbillies, as Granny famously said,
remember what William Jennings Bryan said? Fight hard, but fight clean.
But you ain't fighting clean, Granny.
Of course I ain't. William Jennings Bryan was a loser.
So, tragically. Yeah. So, anyway, There's some funny stuff here. Some interesting things. Now, of course, what does talk radio think of our current president, of President Obama? Well, here's Michael Savage on that.
But that's the least of our problems. The bigger problem is...
Say what? It's not going over my... Oh, it's only playing on the right channel for some reason. Let me see if I can... here we go.
But that's the least of our problems. The bigger problem is that we have a naked Marxist for president here.
Yeah. And here's another beautiful. I mean, this is, you know, just give you a little insight into right-wing talk radio.
Now you want me to tell you my opinion on autism? A fraud. A
autism?
Racket.
Autism? Really? Autism?
For a long while, we were hearing that every minority child had asthma. Why did they suddenly? Why was there an asthma epidemic amongst minority children? Because I'll tell you why. The children got extra welfare if they were disabled, and they got extra help in school. It was a money racket. Everyone went in and was told, when the nurse looks at you, you go,
hear the dog whistle?
I don't know, the dust got me. So everyone had asthma from the minority community. That was number one.
It's not even
now
a dog
whistle. The illness du jour is autism. You know what autism is? I'll tell you what autism is in 99% of the cases. It's a brat who hasn't been told to cut the act out. That's what autism is. What do you mean they scream and they're silent?
Yeah.
They don't have a father around to tell them, don't act like a moron. You'll get nowhere in life. Stop acting like a putz. Straighten up. Act like a man. Don't sit there crying and screaming, idiot.
All right. Okay. So that's the kind of level of discourse that we have right now. Here's – actually, we only have 1 minute. I don't have enough time to get to this. I don't have enough time for that one either. Okay. I when we come back, here's some of the things I want to share with you. Richard Nixon talking about the Vietnam War. Lyndon Johnson talking about the Vietnam War. an incredible bit of music from World War II that the Germans were playing as propaganda inside England. Jack Murtha, thoughts on Dick Cheney. Martin Luther King's Vietnam speech. John Glenn's campaign for president in 1984 as a Republican. John Yoo on whether you should be able to crush the testicles of a child in front of his father as an appropriate interrogation technique by the United States. Spoiler alert, he said yes. He said actually it depends. And Senator Jim Jeffords on why George Bush really went to war. There's some fascinating stuff here. I want to play some of these. We'll do it throughout the day. We've got 3 hours to play here with you. And we've got a lot of great stuff. Plus, we'll be picking up your phone calls. So, you know, it's the end of the year. We can have some fun with this stuff. It's close to the end of the year. It's coming up on the holidays. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Or I guess it is the holidays. Hanukkah's already over, so you can just kind of say Merry Christmas to everybody, I guess. But anyhow, that's coming. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Oh, my. This headline over at Fire Dog Lake. For the first time, anti-terrorism law used to have Americans protesting Keystone XL pipeline arrested. Great. Great. So if you're opposed to the Keystone XL pipeline, you're a terrorist. Just what we needed. By the way, I said that the budget deal had passed the Senate. It didn't pass the Senate. What it did was it passed the filibuster, right? They voted to allow it to go on to be considered. Bernie voted to break the filibuster. I said Bernie had voted for it. I misspoke. My apologies. Went back and, you know, it's a nice thing about the break at the bottom of the hour. I can read. I can catch up on the news and actually read what I'm talking about. So, anyhow, Wendell Willkie, you heard a little clip from him and you heard Granny's opinion of him. He ran for president in 1896, 1900, and 1908. As the Democratic nominee, three times. I don't know of anybody who ran three times. Now, back during the FDR administration, there was... Actually, let me move this over here. Boy, I just don't know where to begin with all this stuff. Okay, let's go back to FDR. There was an attempt to overthrow the President of the United States. And Smedley Butler spoke out about it. And he testified before Congress about this. We've talked about this in the program a lot of times. I don't think you've ever heard his voice, though. The History Channel did a documentary on this, and I lifted this audio out of that, although it's presumably in the public domain because it was testimony before Congress. And so here is Smedley Butler, General Smedley Butler. In 1934-35, he was the most decorated, most famous Marine general in the history of America. Everybody knew his name. He was the, I don't think we have a parallel now. He was the Dwight Eisenhower of his day. And he was recruited by a bunch of rich industrialists. And we're still not sure exactly who, although we've got some pretty good clues. He was recruited to lead a 500,000-man army that was going to occupy the White House and eject President Roosevelt.
I appeared before the Congressional Committee, the highest representation of the American people, under subpoena to tell what I knew of activities, which I believe might lead to an attempt to set up a fascist dictatorship. The plan as outlined to me was to form an organization of veterans, to use as a bluff or as a club at least, to intimidate the government and break down our democratic institutions. The upshot of the whole thing was that I was supposed to lead an organization of 500,000 men, which would be able to take over the functions of government. I felt it was my duty to tell all I knew of such activities to this committee. My main interest in all this is to preserve our democratic institutions. I want to retain the right to vote. I have the right to speak freely and the right to write. If we maintain these basic principles, our democracy is safe.
There you go. And the right to write and the right to protest, except if you're protesting the Keystone XL pipeline, in which case you might be called a terrorist. But in any case, as I've, you know, we've played Roosevelt clips all year. But, of course, here's Rush Limbaugh's opinion of Roosevelt. And this speaks to my debate with C. Edmund Wright, where I said, what is it that Republicans would offer that's affirmative? You want to do away with Obamacare? Fine. But what is it that you would put forward to say, here, this is what we are offering the American people? And what they're offering is to undo the New Deal, is to do away with FDR. You know, if they couldn't depose him by a violent coup in the 1930s, and you just heard Smedley Butler talking about that, well, let's, you know, the death of 1,000 paper cuts, Rush Limbaugh.
Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
And that's pretty it. That's, you know, pretty straightforward. I mean, this is let's undo the New Deal. Let's end it. Let's just say no more. So, anyway, how are Republicans going to get elected? How are they going to succeed? We'll get some more of these clips as we go on here. Bob in Brooklyn. Hey, Bob, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. You were mentioning some of the families who may have been involved with this incident. The DuPont family were involved because at the time they were in control of owned Remington Arms, and they were going to supply Butler with all the arms they needed. And also, let's not forget Prescott Bush, the grandfather of Bush 43. And the father of Bush 43, he was deeply involved with this whole coup attempt.
Well, so it's been alleged. He was an investor with Brown Brothers Harriman at the time. He is one of the few individuals in the history of the United States to have been personally attacked by the President of the United States for basically treason. That Prescott Bush, George W. Bush's grandfather, and George Herbert Walker Bush's father was as a United States senator, and he was also an investment banker. And that he was continuing to help bankroll Hitler after we had declared basically an embargo on all funds with Hitler. But, you know, truth be told, Dick Cheney was doing the same thing. Halliburton was doing business with Iran after we had declared an embargo with Iran. And he became vice president. So it's like, you know, what can you say? But, Bob, thank you for the call. Very interesting. Joan in Ketchikan, Alaska. Hey, Joan, what's up?
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I am great, but I'll get better. How about you?
I'm okay. Hey, I wanted to talk about my experience recently with trying to help some family members connect with some of these alleged social safety, the safety network we're supposed to have in this country.
Right.
I actually used to work for the welfare department, and I thought, oh, this would be easy. I'd be the good person to find out this, but I haven't really worked for them since the mid-90s, since Bill Clinton's block grant, you know.
Right, ending welfare as we know it. Yeah.
Correct. So when in this whole thing about cutting food stamps or SNAP program, I guess it's called now, really concerns me. I'm working with two different states helping family members, and food stamps are like probably the only thing where I've been able to find, help them apply for, or they have applied for, that have been helpful. Mm-hmm. And things like energy assistance is very inconsistent between states. Like one state, you can't get it at all unless you have children under the age of 6. Another state, and this is really weird, there's like a 3-minute window in the state of Washington because they've like given the energy assistance money to the HopeLink program. Anyway, so you got like 3 minutes to call in that day to get on a list.
Wow.
For an appointment that day.
Whoa.
Right, yeah. And
so it's like a game show.
It's like this 3-minute window. And so if you're a working person, it's difficult to get an appointment.
Right.
Because you're on your way to work and you can't use your cell phone in the car in Washington.
Yeah, it's like a bad game show. That's bizarre.
It is. It's a bad game show. Do people not realize that?
Yeah. I think people don't. I think
I pay my taxes all the time, and I have to, like, and I will. I'll be paying their energy assistance. I'm going to be, because there's nothing out there to help people for rent.
Yeah.
There's no more AFDC. There's no rental assistance. There is nothing.
Right.
And so I'm going to have to help them with rent because I'm not going to have my grandchildren homeless.
Mm-hmm.
Do they not realize that that's why I don't go buy a car?
Right. You know, minorities.
That's why I don't buy new clothes. Do they realize that money doesn't grow on trees and that I am now no longer a consumer?
There you go. And thus you're no longer driving the economy. Minorities, particularly African Americans in the United States, have known forever that the deck is stacked, the rich, you know, basically control and run everything, and that there's not that much there for them, and that the social safety net programs that have been put into place by Franklin Roosevelt and Lyndon Johnson have been, you know, seriously damaged. But now that we've got this really serious unemployment crisis that is starting to, in a big way, affect the white community, it's like white people, middle-class white people, who never really understood, you know, what it's like to be homeless or what it's like to be thrown out of their homes or what it's like to be jobless for a long period of time, et cetera, and never had to apply for food stamps or welfare, are starting to figure that out. And, you know, one of the unfortunate realities of American politics is that poor people, white and black, but poor people typically don't participate in the political process, don't vote in large numbers, and are ignored by politicians and the media. But as the, quote, middle class, particularly this large chunk of the white middle class, starts losing their jobs and starts losing their benefits, it is causing the media to pay attention, the largely white media, and it is causing the largely white political establishment to start paying attention. And it's unfortunate that it had to get that bad and it has to move that way for people to notice, but it is happening. And
I feel like I'm on continual Lent. I'm in the process of Lent. This is how I think about it. I'm giving
Lent.
Up certain things.
Oh, I see.
Lent, like for Lent.
Yeah.
I'm giving up certain things.
Well, and that's the thing. It's like
about my family members.
Right, and welcome to what has been the everyday experience of minorities in this country for centuries. And this is like, you know, it's time for all of us to get together and say, the man, you know, the billionaires, they've got nobody's interest at heart. White, black, you name it, you know, Hispanic, whatever. Joan, thank you for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We'll be back with more. I got this Jim Jeffords about, oh, I got to share Lyndon Johnson agonizing over Vietnam. And welcome back, David, in Las Vegas, New Mexico, watching Free Speech TV on Dish Network. Hey, David, what's up?
Actually, I'm in Las Vegas, Nevada, Tom.
Oh, okay.
That's
right.
Okay. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
What a very appropriate discussion this morning. You know, I told your screener that I had just gotten off the phone before I saw you on television with Harry Reid's office. Spoke with a young woman there about the Ryan budget deal, and it's pretty much the Ryan budget deal, and I don't know how it is that no matter how much those of us who are progressive contribute to their campaigns, no matter how much we campaign in their behalf and go door to door and print flyers and everything else, and even win elections, we still have conservative policies.
Yes, we're still in. This is an austerity budget. We have been in austerity since the Reagan Revolution, essentially.
Did you know that I found out this morning online that the National Football League is considered by the IRS to be nonprofit?
Right.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. The NFL is a scam.
And how is that? And what about these one point that you mentioned earlier? These 1.3 million people. It seems almost surreal that it's almost always the holidays when they take the hardest hit. They're just being forgotten by the so-called progressives.
Yeah, 1.3 million people who 3 days after Christmas are going to lose their unemployment benefits because Congress has not acted on this. Now, let me add that you've got people like Bernie Sanders and Harry Reid who are saying we are going to act on this, or we're going to make every effort to act on this. But the problem is it's going to have to get through the Republican House. It's going to have to get through John Boehner, Eric Cantor, Paul Ryan. Good luck with that.
That brings me to my next point. Hmm. And when I spoke with you a couple of years ago, I mentioned to you that we, all of us, myself included, we always talk around the periphery of the issues that we face and the problems of the day. But the underlying illness that we face, and in my mind, until we address it, nothing else really of consequence happens, is this purchasing of our government, this legalized bribery called campaign contributions by corporations. And the Supreme, and I've tried online to find laws and everything else, how in Nevada, how I as an individual could even start something to go to our legislators here to force them to at least take a position on what they feel about the way that campaigns are financed, because I believe they work for us, we should pay for their cost of doing business, and that includes campaigns.
Well, I think that we should be paying for campaigns.
I do too. You know, just like with your radio station there, they provide you, I'm assuming, for the stuff you need to do your work. Just like we provide their desks, we should also not allow people, just because they've got endlessly deep pockets, to steal our elections. Tom, I know you've got a busy day. I appreciate your time. I love you. I just got rid of another cable provider to get back to we now have
the dish seat. Well, thank you. Thank you very much, David. And just for the record, by the way, David, this show is 100% owned by Louise and I, my wife and I, and we bought this desk and all the equipment here, and we pay the salaries of our people, and we offer our show to our radio affiliates and to Free Speech TV at no cost. So thank you, David, very much for the call. We'll be back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. There's just some really poignant stuff. This is, well, maybe I should wait until the next hour and because I've got so many clips here that I want to play for you. LBJ, just because this is almost 2 minutes of clips, and I've only got 8 minutes left, and I got a whole bunch of people on hold. So let's pick up some phone calls, and then I've got to play this clip though. I'll do it in the next hour. 1964, Lyndon Johnson talking to Adlai Stevenson and McGeorge Bundy and Senator Richard Russell about the war in Vietnam. 1964, agonizing over this thing. And then, you know, Shane's got the clip of him talking with, you know, about what Nixon did. We'll get to that, too. Dennis in Marion, Indiana. Hey, Dennis, what's on your mind?
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Good.
Earlier you had a guest on that was suggesting what the Republicans are going to try to undo in 2014 or 2016.
Right.
If that is the best they got to offer, there's going to be a lot of us Republicans voting Democrat. Mm. I need to see a lot more change, a lot more progression in the Republican Party than what I've seen. I unfortunately have been voting, and I'm not going to say unfortunately, I've been voting Democrat because I think Democratic ideas are the best ones I've heard recently. The other thing I wanted to discuss, you had a caller on that was saying the world was 6,000 years old yesterday, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently the gentleman doesn't take time to read his Bible. He'd check on Noah's Ark. I mean, it said God took two of every flesh. It doesn't say he took two of every animal. It's two of every flesh, which means he took the black man, the yellow man, the red man, the rest of us. And in the beginning, it says that God created the heaven, the earth, and he made the earth void, which means that in order to make something void, there had to be something there before, which I'm assuming was the dinosaurs that are 6 million years old. So, I mean, the stuff's in there. They're just misreading it. On the sixth day, he created man and woman.
Yeah.
But on the eighth day...
Well, you know, the official position of the Catholic Church is that a day doesn't have to be a day. I mean, you know, he's that a day might mean, you know, millions of years, that we can have science and religion at the same time.
I mean, even in the New Testament, it says that... A thousand years is but
to the Lord a day may be as a thousand years, or some phrase like that.
I mean,
I'm familiar with
that verse. How many blinks of an eye are there in a day? I mean,
right.
You know,
Right.
I'm really getting tired of religion, I guess, being twisted beyond what it is to conform to other people's ideas and then them trying to push those ideas off on the rest of
them. Yeah, and what saddens me about this is this unholy alliance that the Republican Party created with the religious right. By and large, it was done by George W. Bush when he was working on the campaign of his father in the election of 1992. He was in charge of outreach to the evangelical right, and he's the guy who brought Jerry Falwell into politics in a big way, brought Ralph Reed into politics in a big way, brought Merle Haggard. Ted Haggard, yeah, I think was his name. You know, a bunch of these guys into politics in a really big way, and I think it's harmed both religion and politics. So, Dennis, I'm with you. I got to move along. Let me get some more calls in here. Thanks for the call, though. Thanks for watching us in Marion, Indiana. Grant in Rockford, Illinois, listening to WCPT. Hey, Grant.
Hey, you there?
Yeah, you're on the air.
Okay, I have a quick question. What do you think the outcome is going to be from 1.2 million Americans losing their unemployment? You have 1.2 million people who are going to be put in a situation that they've never been in before.
Yeah. Well, some of them have been in that situation before, but probably about a million of them haven't. And I think that you're going to see an increase in suicide rates. You're going to see an increase in divorce. You're going to see, human misery, human tragedy, assuming that this goes through. My guess is that the Democrats and Republicans will get together right after the first of the year, and they will replace those benefits. That's my guess. I hope I'm right, but I may be wrong. If it does happen, though, you know, it's like, but again, the unemployed are, you know, people losing their homes. They, in a lot of states, they can't vote if they don't have a permanent address or functionally their ID no longer, you know, they haven't updated their driver's license recently. Now they're living in the homeless shelter. So in all these voter ID states, they're not going to be able to vote. They're not just losing their homes. They're basically falling off the edge of the earth, both with regard to economics and politics, which is something that the Republicans are counting on. In fact, they're designing their voting laws so that these folks can't vote. But it's a terrible thing. It's just a terrible thing. Grant, thanks for bringing it up. James in Woodbury, Connecticut. Hey, James, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my phone call.
Sure. Your question?
My question is, it's in regards to Megyn Kelly's remarks on Fox News.
Right.
I kind of find those remarks kind of inappropriate. And I was watching the Alive Factor last night trying to see what he said, and as crazy as this sounds, he's kind of defending what Megyn Kelly said.
Oh, he didn't just kind of defend it. He came right out and said what she said is right.
I know. So my question is Fox News doing this war on Christmas just to try to get ratings?
Yes.
Because I already know that CNN and MSNBC and Progressive Talk Radio is doing a lot better.
Well, Fox is the ratings king when it comes to cable radio and cable TV in the United States. And, yeah, they do pretty much everything just to get ratings. That's the name of the game. Fox is a money-making operation. And, it's kind of a combination of the old P.T. Barnum or whoever it was. No, it wasn't Barnum, but whoever said, you know, nobody ever failed to get rich, underestimating the intelligence of the average American, combined with let's reach out to the lowest common denominator. Let's find an audience. I mean, you only have to have a million or so viewers, at the most a couple million. They had a little over 400,000 people in the 25 to 54 demo that Fox, you know, typically has in their top primetime shows to make a serious amount of money, to make millions and millions of dollars. And you know, they're doing it. They've figured out a way to do that. So what's sad is that it's driving our national political discourse, this relatively small number of viewers with this network that has this outsized power. I think the other reason that Megyn Kelly and Bill O'Reilly feel safe asserting that Santa and Jesus were white, whatever white means, is that the vast majority of the audience of Fox News is white. And so they're basically, you know, it tells you more about what they know about the demographics of their viewers than it does about their politics, frankly, in my opinion, as somebody in the media speaking. We'll be back. In fact, we'll be back with Mike Papantonio.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. EdisonFactor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at solarworld.com, carbonite.com, automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at carbonite.com, angieslist.com, detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at angieslist.com, stamps.com, postage online from your computer. More information at stamps.com, and our website, tomhartmann.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at tomhartmann.com. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you, and Mike Papantonio on the line with us, the attorney, the talk show host with RingofFireRadio.com, Ring of Fire Radio, the weekend show that is heard on so many of our stations and other stations all across the country, and also on Free Speech TV as a TV program, a separate program. RingofFireRadio.com is the website. Pap, how you doing?
Tom, how are you?
I'm well. Merry Christmas and all
Merry
that
Christmas
kind of thing.
To you.
Thank you. So, eminent domain as a way to outsmart the banksters.
Banksters are pretty upset about this. What's happening in counties all over the country? I mean, it's really, you're seeing in California.
This is not just Richmond, California.
No, this is not just Richmond, California. That's one of the places, but this is called reverse eminent domain. It's a really interesting idea, Tom. Most of the time when we think of domain, eminent domain, we think of the government coming in and saying you have to move from your home and we're going to pay you the fair market value for your house.
Right, because we're going to build a bridge or a highway through here.
Exactly.
Or right.
So now what they've done very creatively, turned that around, and they've said that we're going to, as a city or a county or a state, we're going to buy your home. And what we're going to do is we're going to only pay fair market value for the home rather than the inflated predatory mortgage amount that Wall Street had you placed in the home for.
So hang on just a second. Let me set this up. So I've got a $200,000. I got a home that I paid $200,000 for at the height of the bubble.
Right.
The bank is holding a $200,000 mortgage on it. So it's not really me who owns it. It's the bank.
Yeah.
And it's only in the marketplace right now. I couldn't sell it for more than 130.
Right. So 130 is the number you're going to get, and the bank has to take the rest. And
right.
Wall Street really set this whole thing up, Tom. I mean, they're the ones that came up with the predatory.
So the bank has to eat the rest. In other words, the bank gets screwed to the tune of $70,000.
That's exactly right. And the bank ends up, and it falls right within the idea of eminent domain. Here's the argument. If you have a street where four houses are in foreclosure, three houses are not, then what ends up happening on that street is the three homes that are not in foreclosure have to live with the fact that those four homes aren't cared for properly. They're run down most of the time. It actually puts a stress on the city or the county because it requires more policing. It requires more attention.
Property values go down.
Property values are dramatically affected. So a place like New Jersey, Camden, New Jersey, this is another place we see it, says, you know what, we have the right to do this, and banks, you're going to have to live with it. And the bank, of course, Wall Street's furious, even though we look at the story. I mean, this story, you have to remember where it began. It began with these hustlers on Wall Street trying to sell mortgages to people that, A, didn't need the mortgage. Most of them didn't even want the mortgage. They actually went door to door in some of these communities, knocking on doors, trying to get people to get that extra loan on their home and, you know, so they could take the equity out of the home. And so now then they'd take that, they'd bundle it up, and they'd sell it on Wall Street. So now where they're stuck with, if this goes like it should, is they're stuck with having to eat a lot of that money. Look, they've made money going up on the deal. They made a ton of money on CDOs and synthetics and these swap trash that they had on
Wall Street. Not to mention all the fees they made on the original mortgage.
Exactly. And they also made money going back down because the government taxpayers paid them off to the tune of $10 trillion is now where the number has moved to. So we've given them $10 trillion as taxpayers. They're still making money on the back end of it. And the cities are saying, you know, damn it, we're going to take this into our own hands. If you think about it, Tom, what I love about this, it's grassroots fighting back.
Now, has any city actually done this, though, Pap? I know that Richmond started talking about it. The banksters went in and just started raising hell.
They are, look, let me just tell you something. They can raise all the problems they want. What you're going to see Wall Street do is this. Wall Street's going to come in and they're going to say to Richmond, you know, if you do this, what we're going to make it, we're going to put added value, we're going to put added prices on your municipal bonds. You're not going to be, if you want to float a bond, we're going to make it more difficult for you. We're going to argue that your bad judgment with this should increase the risk of buying this bond.
So they're going to try and get the bonds downgraded.
Exactly.
Get the cities downgraded.
Just purely punishment. And then the other thing is
that's an argument for a state bank, you know.
Well,
which is
it
a whole other thing.
Well, you have state
whole
banks.
Another conversation in one state, in South Dakota.
South Dakota, and you don't have, you know, you don't have that kind of influence in the state bank.
Yeah.
So there's
or is it North Dakota, whichever.
You know what? I think it is North Dakota.
Yeah.
But I think the point being, I think that it is a way to fight back, and Wall Street's doing. They're pulling out everything they can. They're going to their senators and representatives and saying this just isn't fair. Well, listen. It's very fair for the homeowner who right now is completely buried in their house, can never pay their way out, and there'll never be an adjustment in the market to ever ever recapture that bubble amount because they won't live long enough to do that.
Right.
So this is a way to fight back. It's brilliant, actually, and I think more communities probably we're going to start seeing are going to be looking at this because if you've driven through some of these communities where all these foreclosed houses are just lined up, it's devastating for a community. It just breeds the kind of the spin to the bottom.
It does, and it's an absolutely brilliant technique. Has this gotten political at all? Have either political parties embraced or rejected this?
No, the Democrats are just as supportive of Wall Street on this as the Republicans. Again, we just always miss this.
This seems like the kind of thing that either party could start winning elections hugely on by just going super populist. The provision for this, for people who don't understand what we're talking about, by the way, the eminent domain, is in the Fifth Amendment. It says that government can take property if there's a benefit to the people, to the government, but it has to reimburse for fair market value. And then that was expanded in the Kelo case to say that could even be, that doesn't have to just be roads and bridges. You can even involve for-profit organizations.
Right, right. I pass this on. Look, everybody listening to this broadcast can pass this idea on to your mayor, to your city council.
Right.
Look, here's the real hypocrisy here. Wall Street is complaining about the idea that what they're doing, they're whining like children, saying what's happening here is they're making us renegotiate the deal we had. Well, you see that all the time. I mean, Donald Trump went bankrupt three times, if you think about it. The only thing that pulled him out of bankruptcy was his ability to renegotiate with the banks. He would say, gee whiz, I owe you so much money, you're into me so much, let me stay with it, but let's reevaluate and renegotiate the amount. This is the same thing. What happens is if Richmond goes forward with this, if these places go forward, they're going to get Wall Street to the table. And they're going to say, you know what, there is a negotiated value we can talk about here, and maybe that's what you want to do. But the point being, to say that this is something that's just unique to the mortgage industry right now is ridiculous. You see banks do this all the time. The Blackstone deal with the New York Times, you may recall, where they went in and they bought the Hilton for $26 billion during the time that the bubble was getting ready to burst. They got swamped in the deal, but they went back and they negotiated and they got that money down. It happens all the time in the business.
Well, banksters will renegotiate with anybody except average working people.
That's exactly right.
I mean, they'll renegotiate with rich people at the drop of a hat.
Well, the reason
or big corporation.
Yeah, it is the old thing we've talked about so many times, and that's the golden rule. The people with the gold make all the rules. Yeah. But right now you have counties and you have mayors and you have activist politicians that can use this to beat the hell out of Wall Street. It would be a very smart thing to do. It's almost reliving the Occupy movement, if you think about it. It is to say, how can we get back at the banks? You can't count on politicians doing it. They're completely owned by politicians.
Do you think it's possible that one of the reasons why Rick Snyder appointed a little dictator to the city of Detroit was to prevent this kind of thing?
Well, you're talking about Orr. No question about it. I mean, he was the perfect appointment. He's the guy that is part of protecting Wall Street.
Yeah, yes. He's definitely not going to do it. And and I know that there was some talk on the Detroit City Council of this.
Yeah.
Detroit's going, talk about a test case. Boy, amazing. Mike Papantonio, ringoffireradio.com. Be sure to check it out. Listen to the program. Pap, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
Great having you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And, of course, you don't just hear Mike Papantonio there. There's Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and Sam Cedar and, a whole great group of people. Ringoffireradio.com. Welcome back. And Mike Papantonio is still on the line with us.
Tom, how are you?
You're there? Yeah, indeed. Great. So let's talk about the Free Speech TV Ring of Fire show, the weekend show on Free Speech TV. What's coming up this weekend?
We got a great show lined up. I'm going to be interviewing Charlie Crist again, talking about what does it mean for the Republican Party to see so much money being pumped into Charlie Crist in what looks like an impossible race, frankly. I mean, you've got Rick Scott is just an awful governor. The guy should be in chains, but now I think he'll hit $100 million worth of money into his campaign. The question is, will the Democrats answer in kind?
$100 million?
$100 million.
That's almost as much money as he was convicted of defrauding the taxpayers.
Yeah, I meant $100 million.
Yeah.
No, $100 million. But yeah, no, he defrauded the taxpayers for $1.7 billion. So,
that's $1,700 million.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's an interesting story. I've got Harold Meyerson from American Prospects going to tell us the problem with Wall Street Democrats and why they're poisoning the Democratic Party. Sam Cedar, co-host on Ring of Fire, is going to talk about the need to support honest, progressive candidates this next go-round and how you can do that. Award-winning filmmaker Sue Wilson is going to tell us why the need to fight back against corporate media by supporting independent journalism and independent news outlets is so critical at this point. And they're going to talk about sweatshop capitalism that's taking place right here in America.
Yeah, and sweatshop capitalism, interestingly, increasingly, the exposés and the articles and even the conventional wisdom is becoming that sweatshop capitalism is in large part a result of not so much Reaganomics, although, screwing the unions didn't help, but Clinton looking for a way to, quote, end welfare as we know it, saying, well, let's make welfare programs available to working people, which they didn't used to be before the Clinton administration. Mm. And as soon as they said, okay, we're going to make welfare available to low-paid working people, a whole lot of employers started saying, okay, well, we'll drop our wages to the point where the government's subsidizing our employees.
Right. Well, wait till TPP hits. Right now you have this administration, secretly pushing TPP ahead. It is going to create a sweatshop America like you just can't imagine, something akin to Saipan. If you talk to the economists that really have projected this, these are very serious people. I mean, they're not, these aren't tinfoil hat economists. They said this TPP has potential to really cause huge harm to this country.
Oh, this is the corporate takeover, the final corporate takeover of America. I mean, it's been going on for quite some time, but, and the Supreme Court obviously, clearly has been the largest aider and abettor of the whole process, but, and kicked open the door for money to come in and corrupt everything else, but, now this is
isn't it great when you don't have to go to Saipan to have a sweatshop? You can have them right all over the South, all over the United States.
Right.
You don't even have to leave the country to get sweatshop labor.
I am increasingly, I debate a lot of Republicans both here on the radio program and on the TV program, and I'm increasingly getting Republicans who are coming on and on the record saying we just shouldn't have any minimum wage laws.
We should not have any minimum wage laws.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah. So let's go back to $3 an hour labor.
Yeah.
Right.
Well,
as
a matter of fact, there are places in Florida, for example, where you're having state legislators passing laws that say you may not pass laws that protect workers. I mean, they have them that specific. And we're going to see more of that.
Yeah, I know Alec is sponsoring stuff like that.
Yeah.
It's amazing. Mike Papantonio, Ring of Fire, the TV show. Right here on Free Speech TV, noon on Sundays Eastern Time, and then replayed throughout the week. And, of course, Ring of Fire Radio as well, ringoffireradio.com. Thanks, Pap.
Thank you, Tom.
It's always great seeing you. We'll be back. So you probably saw all the news reports of the protesters who had set up kind of an Occupy thing in Kiev in Ukraine, and the police marching in and taking down their tents. And it always occurred to me, I thought this is really weird, as I was watching it on TV, and it was on all the networks, watching the police take apart the Kiev protesters that nobody ever mentioned that we did the exact same thing in the United States 2 years ago with Occupy protesters from New York City to San Francisco to South Carolina. Well, it looks like there's some blowback now. A federal appeals court ruled on Monday. This is David Edwards writing for Raw Story. A federal appeals court ruled on Monday that South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley could be sued for violating the civil rights of Occupy Columbia protesters who were removed from the state house grounds and arrested in 2011. The worm turns. Very, very interesting stuff. Very interesting stuff. It is not disputed that South Carolina and the state officials could have restricted the time when the state house grounds are open to the public. However, as explained above, at the time of Occupy Columbia's arrest, no such restrictions existed. So they, you know. So anyhow, back to, I wanted to get back to some of this really cool audio. This is 1964, okay? We're a year after Jack Kennedy has died. Lyndon Johnson, in December of 63, Lyndon Johnson, that I have personal knowledge of, Harry Williams was in the room with Lyndon Johnson and Bobby Kennedy when LBJ said that he was going to give up on his attempts to do anything about Cuba. And because as a Democrat or as an American politician back in that day, you had to take a stand against communism. And so what Lyndon Johnson told Harry Williams, according to Harry Williams, what Harry Williams told me, Lyndon Johnson said to him and Bobby Kennedy, was instead of taking a stand against communism in Cuba, I'm going to do it as far away from this country as I possibly can. Now, because, you know, in part at that time, he was still of the opinion, Lyndon Johnson was of the opinion that Castro had killed Kennedy, which kind of drove part of his hysteria. But in any case, so he starts this thing in Vietnam. And so here we are in May 27th, 1964. The war in Vietnam is really just starting in a serious way. And Lyndon Johnson's on the phone. There's three conversations. The first you're going to hear is Adlai Stevenson. The second is with McGeorge Bundy. And the third is with Senator Richard Russell. So two members of his administration and close advisors and a Republican senator. Richard Russell. Russell might have been a Democrat. I'm not sure. In any case, one of the leaders of the Senate. Here's Lyndon Johnson agonizing over the Vietnam War as it was starting, or in the early days of it, as it was really kicking off.
Me over there. That'd be fine. And you be thinking about it. I want to have some talks with you. And if you get free, you just pick up the phone and call me during the afternoon sometime.
All right, sir. Fine.
I want to. I shudder at the. Getting too deeply involved there, and everybody thinks that's the only alternative.
Well, I've been shuddering on this thing for 3 years, and I'm afraid we're in a position now where you don't have any alternative, and it's a hell of an alternative. And it really gives me the shakes, but I don't know. He was going to give me all the up-to-date planning.
So that's Adlai Stevenson saying, basically, you gotta go for this war in Vietnam.
I think you ought to plan that basis. I'll tell you, the more I just stayed awake last night thinking about this thing, the more I think of it, I don't know what in the hell. It looks like me we're getting into another Korea. It just worries the hell out of me. I don't see what we can ever hope to get out of there with once we're committed. I believe the Chinese communists coming into it. I don't think that we can fight them 10,000 miles away from home and ever get anywhere in that area. I don't think it's worth fighting for, and I don't think we can get out. And it's just the biggest damn mess. It is. So. It's an awful mess. And we just got to think about it. I look at this sergeant of mine this morning. Got six little old kids over there, and he's getting out my things and bringing me in my night reading and all that kind of stuff. And I just thought about ordering those kids in there, and what in the hell am I ordering him out there for?
What is Vietnam worth to me?
What is Laos worth to me? What is it worth to this country?
Now we got a treaty, but
everybody else got a treaty out there, and they're not doing anything about it.
Yeah.
Now, of course, if you start running the communists, they may just chase you right into your own kitchen.
Yeah. So here that's McGeorge Bundy trying to talk LBJ into a war after Adlai Stevenson did. Here's that Richard Russell.
Well, think about it, and I'll talk to you again. I hate to bother you, but I've just...
I can't be. God knows I do, because it's a terrific quandary that we're in over there, just
We're just in the quicksands up to our very necks. I just don't know how, what the hell's the best way to do about it.
I love you, and I'll be calling you.
I'll see you soon.
LBJ, May 27th, 1964. He was having a very bad day. The night before, the sergeant who brought him his reading materials, who the guy who worked in the White House and brought him his stuff, said he's got some of his kids over there in Vietnam. And LBJ having this crisis of conscience, and he went through a series of calls to advisors and counselors and friends saying, what do I do about this damn Vietnam thing? And they're all giving him reasons why we should be in Vietnam. And he was very skeptical. That was 64. And then when he ended the war in 68, Richard Nixon blew it up. And here he is talking to Senator Everett Dirksen about that.
Well, now, what do you think we ought to do about it?
Well, I better get in touch with him, I think, and tell him about it.
I think you better tell him that his people are saying to these folks that they oughtn't to go through with this meeting. Now, if they don't go through the meeting, it's not going to be me that's hurt. I think it's going to be whoever's elected, and maybe my guess, him.
Yeah.
And I think they're making a very serious mistake, and I don't want to say this.
Yeah.
And you're the only one I'm going to say it to.
Yeah, this is Lyndon Johnson. And then, you know, later on he says this is treason. He's talking to Everett Dirksen. We'll play that clip when we come back from the break because we're just about to hit the break. But, so in 64, he's agonizing over it. 4 years later in 68, he has negotiated an end to it. And Richard Nixon blows up the negotiation so that he can beat Hubert Humphrey in the 1968 election. Humphrey was the vice president under LBJ. And Humphrey was taking a lot of heat for that war. If LBJ had been able to end this war, Humphrey would have been president.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
But Nixon went to the South Vietnamese, or his campaign did, and said, don't go to the Paris peace talks. Don't do the deal you've negotiated with LBJ. And therefore, he won the presidency. Remember back during the John Kerry for president campaign? John Kerry was running against George W. Bush. And, you know, it came down to Ohio, and the votes got ultimately counted in Kentucky on the vote counting machine that or by the company that was providing secure email to Karl Rove and the Bush White House. But that's a whole other story. But the you know, Ken Blackwell and all that stuff. But there was a bishop or a cardinal, a Catholic cardinal. His name was Raymond Burke, who came out and said that Catholics should not take communion if they voted for Kerry, because Kerry was in favor of a woman's right to choose to have an abortion. And therefore, he was whatever the official Catholic word is for, you know, an apostate or what. I don't know the language, but whatever. Well, Cardinal Burke just got kicked out by the Pope, Pope Francis. He was part of the office that nominates bishops and things, and it's called the Vatican High Court, the Apostolic Signatura. He's still a priest and everything, but he just, you know, he no longer has this incredible position of power. I just find this fascinating. This Pope, you know, yeah, I still have some problems with Catholicism, with any organized religion. And there's no rational organized religion. Anyhow, back in 64, I just played the clip for you a few minutes ago of Lyndon Johnson in 64 agonizing with three different advisors saying, I really don't want to do this Vietnam War thing. And all three of them saying, oh, no, you got to do it. You got treaties. You got, you know, here's why you got to do it. Okay. So then in 68, 4 years later, a bunch of us were out in the street. I was out in the streets in 68 chanting, hey, hey, LBJ, how many kids did you kill today? Getting tear gassed and pepper gassed on Grand River Avenue in East Lansing, Michigan. All across the country this was going on. And you had the police riot in Chicago at the Democratic National Convention. The Chicago 7 came out of that, as I recall. But what we didn't know, what America didn't know, is that Lyndon Johnson had actually negotiated an end to the war in Vietnam in 68. which would have saved the lives of another million Vietnamese and 10, 20, 30,000 Americans. I don't know where how many Americans had died at that point. It was substantial, but it got a lot worse as time went on. And Richard Nixon went over, or his advisors went over, his campaign went over to contact the Vietnamese and said essentially the same thing that Reagan's advisors said to the Iranians when they took the hostages, is don't negotiate with this president during this election, because I'll give you a better deal when I become president. Now, in the case of Reagan, it was that he would sell weapons to the Iranians, who had, you know, the Shah had an entirely American, you know, military, and they needed spare parts. And in fact, they cut the deal in the summer of 1980, the Reagan campaign. Bill Casey cut that deal. And by the fall of 1980, they were already delivering via Israel spare tires for the F-15s, I think they were, or whatever they were, F-14s. For the fighter jets that the Iranian army had. So we were already, you know, doing that deal, and that's why President Bonnie Sauter is writing about this in the Christian Science Monitor just in March of this year. But when Lyndon Johnson was president in 68, the CIA had intercepted the conversations between Madam Tu and the Vietnamese and the Nixon administration, or the Nixon campaign. Nixon was running against Vice President Hubert Humphrey in 1968, and Lyndon Johnson had negotiated peace between South and North Vietnam. And all they had to do was go to Paris to ratify what he had negotiated. And once the word of that got out, Hubert Humphrey would have won in a cakewalk. Because if you took Vietnam off the table, people loved what Lyndon Johnson was doing. He cut poverty in half in America. It was the second New Deal. So when LBJ, when the CIA comes to LBJ, and this was just released a couple of years ago by the LBJ Library, the CIA comes to LBJ and they say, you know, we've got these tapes of Nixon and his buddies talking to the South Vietnamese saying, don't do a peace deal with LBJ before the election. Wait until after the election. And so LBJ calls up Everett Dirksen, who was arguably one of the two most powerful, in fact, Dirksen built office buildings named after him here, just three blocks from where I'm broadcasting from. It's where Bernie's office is, I think. I'm pretty sure he's in the Dirksen building, not the Hart building. Whatever. Anyhow, it's just a couple blocks from here. And when the CIA says this to LBJ, he calls up Everett Dirksen, the senior statesman, Republican in the Senate. And you just heard a minute ago him saying to Dirksen, you got to tell them. You got to speak to them and try to do something. Here he's calling back because nothing's happening. Here's what LBJ said.
Here's the latest information we got. The agent says that they just talked to the boss in New Mexico. And that he says that you must hold out. Just hold on until after the election. We know what Chu is saying to them out there.
Yeah.
We're pretty well informed on both ends. Now, I'm reading their hand, Everett. I don't want to get this in the campaign.
That's right.
And they oughtn't to be doing this. This is treason.
I know.
This is treason. So Richard Nixon came to office by treason. Ronald Reagan came to office by treason. And George W. Bush came to office by his brother knocking 80,000 African-Americans off the polls, off the rolls, off the voting rolls in Florida, so he could get close enough that it could be thrown to the Supreme Court. So I stand by my assertion, and I'm amazed that the right wing has not picked this up and gone ballistic at me about it, but I think it's because they don't want to talk about it. That we have not had a legitimately elected Republican president of the United States since Dwight Eisenhower. And up until Dwight Eisenhower declared his candidacy as a Republican, most people thought he was going to run as a Democrat because he had always been apolitical. He was a military man. And you heard in the 1940 Republican, Wendell Willkie, talking about how I stand in favor of, you know, organized labor, and I stand in favor of Social Security, and I stand for regulated capitalism, and we need to regulate the banks. We need to regulate Wall Street. That was the Republican candidate for president. So anyhow, so Nixon commits this treason, and then he goes out and he gives this speech. This is Nixon's 1968 RNC speech. Oops, hang on just a minute. There we go.
For 4 years, this administration has had the support of the loyal opposition for the objective of seeking an honorable end to the struggle. Never has so much military and economic and diplomatic power been used so ineffectively. And if after all of this time and all of this sacrifice and all of this support, there is still no end in sight, then I say the time has come for the American people to turn to new leadership not tied to the mistakes and the policies of the past. That is what we offer to America.
You get this? He's campaigning on LBJ's inability to end Vietnam.
You realize that we face the stark truth that we are worse off in every area of the world tonight than we were. We've had enough of big promises and little action. The time has come for honest government in the United States of America. And there is only one answer to such a record of failure, and that is a complete house cleaning of those responsible for the failures on that record.
Richard Nixon in 1968, speaking at the Republican National Convention, while he's sabotaging the peace talks with Vietnam, attacking LBJ, just listen to the beginning of this, for not having peace with Vietnam.
For 4 years, this administration has had the support of the loyal opposition for the objective of seeking an honorable end to the struggle. Never has so much military and economic and diplomatic power been used so ineffectively. And if after all of this time and all of this sacrifice and all of this support, there is still no end in sight.
Well, you know how the rest of it goes. So, you know, no end in sight because Richard Nixon made it that way. And he became president in 1968, and he kept that war going for another 4 years. He did what George W. Bush told his biographer, Mickey Herskowitz, in 1999 that he would do. You know, he said the mistake that my daddy made was having a 100-hour war with Iraq. He says, if I get to be president, I'm going to be a war president, and I'm going to have a successful presidency. In other words, he was going to privatize Social Security. And you recall, right after the 2004 election, in January 2005, he said, I got all this political capital. I'm going to try and privatize Social Security. And Cindy Sheehan went before John Conyers Commission and committee in the House and you know, basically quoted Mickey Herskowitz in, with George W. Bush saying that. We don't have time to play the clip, or do we? There you go. Play it.
As a matter of fact, in interviews in 1999 with respected journalists, and longtime Bush family friend, Mickey Herskowitz, then Governor George Bush stated, one of the keys to being seen as a great leader is to be seen as commander-in-chief.
Seen as.
My father had all this political capital built up when he drove the Iraqis out of Kuwait, and he wasted it. If I have a chance to invade, if I had that much capital, I'm not going to waste it. I'm going to get everything passed that I want to get passed, and I'm going to have a successful presidency, end quote.
So there you have three Republican, illegitimate Republican presidents, all of whom used the death of Americans in war to further their ends.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
This is such an indictment of the Republican Party. And then I debate these guys like Edmund Wright. Now, what do you have to offer the American people? Well, we'll do away with Obamacare. Welcome back. 15 minutes before the hour. And Rick in Weston, West Virginia. Hey, Rick, what's on your mind today? Rick, you are on the air. No. Rick's listening to his TV rather than watching his phone or listening to his phone. Got to listen to your phone. Jeff in Langston, Pennsylvania. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
Reading your book, it's a wonderful book. Everybody,
Crash of 2016.
Read it. Everybody from regardless of their party affiliation. What I wanted to ask you, Tom, and that those tapes really got me because I enlisted in 1968. It's 17 years old. I was too young to go to Vietnam. But in 1970, I got pulled out of Germany, and they sent me over there. And I can still remember before we were assigned to our units, we were listening to some Armed Forces radio, and Tricky Dick was bragging about how he was pulling the troops out of Vietnam. And he wasn't doing that.
No.
You know, there was more of us going over.
No, he kept it going for the election 72.
It really, it, 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 when I heard that, that you know, these are people's lives just to win an office. I mean, that just blows me away. I mean, being a Vietnam vet and a disabled Vietnam vet at that. And, you know, then I'm hearing the one question I wanted to ask you was, I heard, it might have been on MSNBC, I'm not sure, that they're going to do something with, you know, retired military people, but they didn't specify anything. They're going to take something away from that. And I guess I was wondering, in your opinion, do you think that's cost of living, or are these people crazy enough that they want to start taking some of their benefits away from them?
My understanding of what they're doing is that they're cutting military pensions. Now, it may be that they're increasing, I know for federal employees what they're doing is they're increasing by 1.3% the amount that new hires have to pay into the federal employee pension fund to fund their own pensions. It may be that there's something like that going on with the military. I don't remember the details of the military side of it, but it's not going to, I know it won't affect existing pensioners, but, in both cases, they made it, you know, to hit people in the future, because if you hit people in the present, they'll stand up and squawk and yell and raise hell about it. And then you got a political problem.
Right. Well, I'm a lifetime member of the DAV. And,
as was my grandfather.
Was he?
Yeah, you're disabled from World War One.
Yeah, World War One. Well, yeah, and just think, even back then, Tom, the bonus army, you know, they had to get down to Washington D.C.
Yep.
And I'll just end with this, you know, I mean, you're right. I mean, when you listen to those tapes, I mean, three illegitimate Republican presidents. I mean,
it's mind-boggling.
It's mind-boggling.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. It's like, you know, what has this country come to? And this is how that party, the Republican Party, the only way that they can win elections is either by you know, ginning up fear typically of gay people or black people or you know, women who want to get abortions or whatever, by ginning up fear, or by rigging elections, by gerrymandering, by passing laws, making it so that people can't vote. Throwing people off the voting rolls like Jeb Bush did down in Florida with Catherine Harris back in 2000. I mean, it's incredible. It's absolutely incredible. Jeff, thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for your service to your country. It's a tough thing joining the military during a time of war. Damn tough thing. 10 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Harmon here with you, and let's check in with Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com, where you can give a gift of a goat to a returning slave in South Sudan. Goatsfortheoldgoat.com is the only animal group that gives you a picture of your goat and the recipient, and in all probability that picture was taken by Ellen Ratner, who is on the phone with us. Hey, Ellen.
Well, yes, I just want to talk about South Sudan for a quick second. And first of all of your listeners and viewers who do buy a goat, the goats happen in a very different part of the country than the fighting is taking place as we speak. And so people will still get the goats, and I'll still go. Although today I was supposed to be where the fighting is in Juba, and the trip just got canceled 3 days ago, having nothing to do with this. But the fighting looks quite intense. There have been several casualties. There are up to 13,000 people taking refuge in two of the UN compounds, which I believe you've been to when we were in Juba.
Yeah.
And, I mean, you've been... Juba's not a very big place.
No.
And you've seen most of it.
Yeah, it's the capital and the biggest city, but it's like there were, what, at the time that we were there, were like 15 miles of paved roads?
In the whole country, that's correct.
Right, most of it was in Juba.
Right, and as you recall, Tom, we went up to John Garang's grave, which is actually where they had the ceremonies for the new country on July 9th, 2011. Well, it looks like the vice president that Salva Kiir got rid of, and of course we have photos of you with Salva Kiir, the president of the country, and it looks like that possibly, and this is what I hear from my folks, that not only the vice president, who is a Nuer, not a Dinka, and who was accused during the war of killing 2,000 Dinkas, and Salva Kiir dismissed him, put him sort of together a unity government, it looks like there's a possibility of John Garang's wife connecting with this guy so that the two of them could run the country and throw out Salva Kiir.
So, in a way, this is a tribal conflict.
Yes. In some respects, it's a tribal conflict.
And therefore, in a way, you could say that if Europeans hadn't artificially drawn lines creating countries, throwing tribes together and into conflict with each other, we wouldn't be having these wars in Africa right now.
The Brits messed it up beyond. That is for sure. You're absolutely right about that. But in some respects, it also, you know, there's a lot of corruption in South Sudan, as you know. And the one thing I can say about the president of the country is that he personally is not corrupt. Now, he may have a lot of corrupt people around him, but he personally isn't. And that's why he got rid of his cabinet this summer. Well, a lot of people think that this new, the guy that's fighting him, it's really a fight for oil and power and
sure.
money.
Well, and it is. I mean, they found oil there. The Chinese are buying it. The Norwegians are metering it. The North is taking half the money, I think, isn't it?
Is that right? Yes. That was supposedly the deal, that the North would get half the money.
Yeah. So it's all and it looks like maybe they're getting more than that, and it's just all a mess.
It's very much a mess in what's going on in South Sudan. And the State Department today told all Americans to leave South Sudan.
Wow. Wow. Well, I'm glad you're not there right now, Alan.
I'm a little glad I'm not there, too. I worry, though, because honestly, I think it's going to be hard for me to get my group of physicians there in March. But
yeah.
People don't, you know, they don't have the guts that you and I do sometimes. Okay. And you certainly know a lot about Africa. A couple other interesting things. Well, it looks as if, in fact, there is going to be, the budget is going to get through. They did get the 67 votes needed for cloture. In other words, to get the vote to the floor. And now it needs a simple majority. Now there are people such as the senators from Tennessee, Corker and why am I blocking last name? But you know who the two senators from Tennessee, both.
Yeah, is that Thad Cochran or?
Cochran,
whoever.
Mississippi. Yeah. Anyway, they are voting against
Lamar Alexander.
Is Lamar still there? I believe so. They are voting against the bill, but they voted for cloture.
Right.
So, or at least one of them did. So, essentially, they can then go back home to their constituents and say, "Well, I really believe that we should have this on the floor so we could see a vote, and that's why I voted against it." Well, but in fact, you really voted for it if you voted for those 60 votes, because then you know the Democrats with their 55 people, even if somebody like Bernie Sanders, who's not a Democrat but caucuses with them, drops out, then they can say, well, the Democrats really voted for this and I voted against it. It's just a political ploy, honestly.
Right, but it's so weird because Paul Ryan is the guy who's taking most of the credit for it.
That's right. Well, he and Patty Murray seem to get along for some strange reason that I have yet to...
Yeah, did you read that long New York Times, I think it was, or Washington Post article about how they've become such good buddies and she calls him up after a football game and stuff like that?
Yes. Well, you know, Washington actually used to be like that, for better or for worse. It certainly isn't like that anymore.
Yeah.
A couple other things. You have one of the last surviving Blue Dog Democrats, Jim Matheson. He's from Utah. He is not running for re-election. And Frank Wolf, very well-known Republican from Virginia, also not running for re-election.
Right.
They announced that.
I'm guessing in both cases it's because they could sense which way the wind was blowing.
Right. One, they could sense which way the wind is blowing. And two, I'm not sure, I didn't look into it, whether Wolf has a Tea Party fight on his right. But, you
but
know,
see, I thought Matheson might have a progressive primary challenge.
He may have a progressive, that's right. And he may know that he's just not going to go anywhere.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Now, this is very interesting. Today there was a hearing at Senate Intelligence. Dianne Feinstein was running it. Carolyn Crass is her name. She was the lawyer at the Justice Department legal counsel. She has been acting director, et cetera, there. And she basically had some strong words, although she started to sort of be a little mealy-mouthed in the beginning. She had some very strong words about the fact that she does not believe that Office of Legal Counsel, OLC, as it's called, opinions should necessarily be shared with the Senate. These include things like waterboarding opinions.
Whoa. So the old John U. J. Bybee stuff is still confidential, or?
Well, it's not.
Or the modern day version of
it. It should necessarily be.
Huh. Amazing. Helen Radner with the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com, where Helen does this great work in South Sudan. Helen, thank you for being with
thank
us today.
You.
Good talking. We will be back with Malcolm Out Loud.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. Edison Factor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartman.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartman.com. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Jim, were you just saying they're redoing the song to Megyn Kelly's Dreaming of a White Christmas? No, not really. Come on. Welcome back. Malcolm Out Loud is on the phone with us. MalcolmOutLoud.tv is the website. He is a news and political commentator of the more or less conservative persuasion and host of the TV show Malcolm Out Loud. Malcolm, welcome back to the program.
How you doing, Tom?
I am fine, thank you.
And by the way, Merry Christmas.
Well, Merry Christmas to you. What's this? I understand you're all you got your panties in a wad here about the war on Christmas.
Yeah, no, I think you got the wrong cat for that. I think it really comes down to the bigger picture is our tolerance in this country. Mm-hmm. I think we've become a less tolerant society, Tom, all the way around. And I think this is just another opportunity for obviously conservatives to go after conservatives to go after liberals to go after conservatives. It's just another opportunity for media bashing. And so, hey, we'll all join in the fun, huh, with the war on Christmas, you know?
Well, so you disagree with your colleagues over at Fox News that there's a war on Christmas.
It's all fun and cheek. That's correct. I caught you off guard, buddy. I know you're always looking for a good conservative to bash, but,
or to debate. I mean, I was hoping to actually have a conversation about the topic, and maybe we still can. Why do you think that Bill O'Reilly and Megyn Kelly and all the others over at Fox News would be so outspoken that there is a, you know, that this is like, you know, the end of America. This is a cultural war if America doesn't continue to be, in their mind, always has been, a Christian country with Christian holidays, that we are somehow doomed. I mean, what is motivating that?
Well, I mean, you know, our origins of our country. I mean, we are a Judeo-Christian country.
No, the founders were mostly deists. I mean, Thomas Jefferson he wasn't a Christian.
Is our motto. There are a lot of people who disagree with that. I mean, listen, you know, majority of Americans are Christians. I mean, the ratio is maybe 10-20% are not. But I think it's about acceptance, Tom. I think it's about if somebody says to me, "Happy Martin Luther King Day" or "Happy Kwanzaa" or whatever it is, I take that as it's just fine. I would answer the back, same to you. I mean, what's wrong with accepting each other's differences? I think that's what unites our country, Tom. And too many people, again, I think it's just something that that we can rag on and say. But there are examples of that.
Well, let me just, this is, the press release that you sent out, which came out from mediaproductions.tv, says, guest opportunity, Malcolm Out Loud, national commentary. There is a war raging in America, and it is for the very soul of the country. In the crosshairs of atheists is the Christmas holiday itself. Through efforts from atheist organizations, nativity scenes, Christmas trees, and depictions of baby Jesus are no longer acceptable at courthouses or other government buildings in America. You know, Malcolm Out Loud is a true, no-holds-barred commentator. The soul and future of America lies in the balance of this war on Christmas. Are you repudiating your own press release?
Not at all. Not at all. You just read the way you read into it. That's all, man.
No, I read you. I read word for word what it says in your press release.
Yeah. Well, again, that's fine.
Did I not? Did I misrepresent it in any way?
I don't know. Did you?
Well, I'm holding my hand. I'm assuming that you're familiar with the press release. It goes out over your name.
It goes out from the publicist. The exact words, I don't know. My point is tolerance and acceptance. I would have very much a very similar viewpoint as you in this case, Tom. I would think that we need to be more acceptance as people and as a country, and I don't think there's anything wrong with putting a nativity scene up or putting a Christmas tree up, saying Merry Christmas. You go to the store, some clerk may be more comfortable with saying Happy Holiday.
Well, how do you feel about your tax dollars being used?
Whatsoever.
How do you feel about your tax dollars being used to put up a flying spaghetti monster in the State House in Wisconsin?
That would do nothing for me.
It's a church. I mean, it's the Church of the Flying Spaghetti Monster. They got a nativity scene there, a Christian one. They've got a Festivus pole, I guess, now. They do it down in Florida. You know, Rick Scott's got himself a Festivus pole made out of beer cans. It's got Megyn right. Kelly all upset. Isn't it time for us to say, you know, when the founders said there should be no religious test for office in the Constitution, and then in the First Amendment said, you know, that there shall, you know, basically there shall be no state religion, that the United States, and when George Washington, you know, negotiated the Treaty of Tripoli, came out and said, and this was, you know, negotiated by George Washington, written by James Madison, and executed during the John Adams administration with Thomas Jefferson as Secretary of State. So all four of those guys involved in this. And the opening sentences, as the United States of America is in no way a Christian nation. Isn't it time to say, you know, the founders would not have allowed this. James Madison, the fourth president of the United States, his first veto as president, and he's quite proud of it. You can easily Google this. His first veto as president was vetoing a bill that gave money to churches in Washington, D.C. to run the poorhouse that George Washington had established. The government had been funding the poorhouse, had been paying for health care, for food, and for lodging, and for clothing for poor people in Washington, D.C. during the George Washington administration, the John Adams administration, and the 2 years of the Thomas Jefferson administration. And then Madison comes along, and they want to start running it through the church. And he said, no, we will not give federal money to the church, period.
Okay. But
and Madison was the only one of those guys who actually proclaimed himself to be a Christian.
But twice Congress has voted on the fact that In God We Trust is our official motto. Why is that?
Because it was the 1950s, and you had Joe McCarthy running around with his crazy rhetoric about the godless communists were trying to get us, and we were trying to distinguish ourselves from the godless Soviet Union that was officially atheistic. That's why.
But you went back to the origins of our country.
No, our country was not founded in 1950.
But that still makes it relevant today as much as the beginning of our country.
I mean, I was founded in 1951. But,
you know, look at Chicago. Let me bring this point up with you. Take a look at Chicago right now, the Daily Plaza Hotel display. There are a lot of talk about that red neon sign, the A there for atheism, right?
But that's private property. I don't care what happens on private property. I do care what happens on property that is being paid for with my tax dollars.
Well, listen, my point is, it wasn't the tax dollars.
And so what you're saying is that property is paid for with our tax dollars. If you want to put a religious symbol up there, whether it's a Church of the Flying Spaghetti Monster or whether it's a creche, that's fine with you. And I don't get why any conservative would say that. Barry Goldwater wouldn't have said that.
Well, let me say this to you, Tom. We celebrate Christmas as a federal holiday in this country. Christmas is the birth of Jesus Christ.
Where did the Christmas tree come from? Where did the Christmas tree come from, Malcolm?
Let me finish this.
Where did the Christmas tree come from?
Christ, Jesus Christ. That is the birth of Jesus Christ.
Now, the Christmas tree came from the pagan ritual, where on the shortest day of the year, the priest would go up to the tallest mountain and light in Germany and light the tallest tree that he could find and to reignite the sun. That's where the Christmas tree came from.
Tom,
this is a pagan holiday.
Are you a believer or a non-believer?
It's the solstice. It doesn't matter whether I believe or don't believe. The fact of the matter is that Christmas is not a strictly Christian holiday. You've got pagans who are celebrating the solstice. You've got Jews who are celebrating Hanukkah, more or less in that same neighborhood of time, although this year it was a little earlier. You've got Christians who are celebrating the birth of Jesus Christ, which by the way, seems to have happened in March.
What they want to celebrate and be who they want to be, and whatever that
But
is,
not on
is,
my taxpayer dime.
What's that?
But not on my taxpayer dime.
Well, you'll have to get over it, Hal, because if people agree and they're going to put these symbols up, so be it. Listen.
So you're in favor of the tyranny of the majority.
More taxes. Tom, let me talk a minute. You talk too much over me. Our government, who you support, waste more tax dollars on frivolous things, and you're worried about a symbol that recognizes Jesus Christ for Christmas?
I'm worried about the integrity of the Constitution.
You need to go back and read it again. Thank you.
Okay. Malcolm Out Loud. MalcolmOutLoud.tv is the website. Thank you, Malcolm.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I'm not sure he heard me say thank you because he hung up. Oh, well. 15 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. 15 minutes past the hour. Boy, that was interesting. Sort of. Anyway, we'll pick up some phone calls here. Dustin in Reno, Nevada. Hey, Dustin, thanks for watching Free Speech TV on the DirecTV satellite. What's up?
Hey, that was some good stuff there. That was a great interview just a moment ago. I wanted to touch base with you on some stuff with getting into this Santa debate.
Mm-hmm. You know, about whether Santa was white or whether Santa should be appearing on the State House lawn.
All that stuff.
All of the above, okay.
First of all, exactly. First of all, Santa is based off of St. Nicholas.
Right.
And so the debate should be, was St. Nicholas white? And he was Mediterranean white. So
right, he was Turkish, actually.
There you go. And
yeah. When Greece owned that part of the world, but it was Turkey. It's what's today Turkey. So.
Right.
So
today
if
it's the southern coast of Turkey, correct?
Right.
But at that time, it was Greek, and so. But I think it's irrelevant. People are focusing on the wrong things, and you know, that guy Saint Nicholas, he sold off everything that he owned and gave all the money to the poor, and then was imprisoned. But you know, no one seems to even care about that.
Was that his story? I'm frankly ignorant of the story of Saint Nicholas.
Yeah, that's his story, and but it shouldn't matter whether he was white or black. And frankly, I don't care. If I see a black Santa, it's not going to bother me one bit.
Well, I always figured that different cultures that celebrate Christmas and have Santa Claus as part of it, that Santa speaks their language. I mean, when we lived in Germany, they're all about Santa Claus, and Santa Claus speaks German in Germany. And so if he speaks different languages in different countries, you would expect that he probably has this, you know, if he fits into the local culture, he probably looks like the local people as well as sounds like them.
Correct.
Doesn't that make sense?
I agree.
I mean, it just makes sense. And why black kids in America, I mean, you know, they've had to put up enough of this crap all their lives with, for example, the standards of beauty being exclusively white in the United States. Really, just up until the last couple of decades. Now you've got programs like Scandal and whatnot, where you've got, you know, black leading ladies who are, you know, just stunning. You know, it's like, you know, it was always the standards of beauty were white, and then you get Megyn Kelly, who was an old beauty queen, saying, and Santa Claus, by the way, is white. It's like, whack, little black kids. You know?
Well, the point where they're coming from and why they seem so matter-of-fact is because they're just going off of St. Nicholas's appearance.
No, I think it's because because Fox News' audience is overwhelmingly white.
I don't even watch Fox News. I'm going to disagree with you there. I think they're just going off of historical facts. But I think we're getting too caught up in the division. We're letting so many things divide us. This race stuff should not be an issue anymore. We're fueling the fire. So we can't add fuel to the fire. You have
How
to
are you fueling
that.
The fire of racism when you point out racism?
Because it's non-existent. It's
racism is non-existent in the United States?
There's no racism right now with Santa Claus in our country. It didn't exist.
Dustin, if you were black and all the Santas you saw were white, you wouldn't find that uncomfortable or weird, or you wouldn't feel excluded?
As a matter of fact, I would not. And some of my
okay, you're speaking as a white guy, Dustin. And some of your best friends are. Oh. Dustin, thank you for the call. We'll be back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 20 minutes past the hour. Okay, I we will take your calls in a few minutes here, but I want to get back to some of these clips. This morning I was just going through these and finding so many great pieces. We were talking about the Vietnam War before and, you know, how Nixon basically blew up the peace talks in 68 and then 72, he kept the war going so that he could get himself reelected. And then 73, Watergate comes out, and he's going down in flames. And as the testimony is happening that is going to lead to his impeachment if he doesn't resign, Nixon gets a call from John Haldeman. And this is like, you know, 2 days before he resigns from office. Richard Nixon talking to John Haldeman. I found this fascinating.
Hello.
Hi.
Hope I didn't let you down.
No, sir. You got your points over, and now you got to set right and move on. You're in right where you ought to be.
That's Haldeman.
Well, it's a tough thing, Bob, for you, for John, the rest, but God,
this is Nixon.
I'm never going to discuss this son of a butching Watergate thing again. Never, 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 never. Don't you agree?
Yes, sir. You've done it now, and you've laid out your position, you've laid out your, mm-hmm. you've taken your steps, you've put the...
Interesting thing, you know, we haven't heard of the only cabinet officer that is called, and this is 50 minutes after the thing is over, is Cap Weinberger, bless his soul. Mm-hmm. All the rest, you know, are waiting to see what the polls show. God, strong cabinet, isn't it?
You better check and be sure, because that... They may, you know, we've had a...
No. They know who to call, you know. They know they can get
through.
It's
old paranoid Nixon.
But in any event, I just want you to know that Cap called, and he was all the way...
Cap, who was indicted during the Reagan administration.
Say, you're a strong man, God damn it, and I love you. And I, you know, I love John.
We're
all the rest. And by God, keep the faith. Keep the faith. You're going to win this son of a bitch.
Absolutely.
You notice what I said about the violence and so forth on the other side.
Yeah.
I mean, there were some intricacies in this that only the sophisticated will understand.
I got those, and I want to get the text because there's some things to work on from there. But.
All right.
But we can build.
I thought it was good, too, to sort of end on what I deeply felt, you know, the religious note, you know.
Yeah.
God bless America. I mean, I'm sure it must have, you know, driven you up the wall. Didn't drive me up the wall, but I felt that way.
I know that I'm all for that. Completely agree.
I don't know whether you can call and get any reactions and call me back, or, you know, like the old style. Would you mind?
I don't think I can.
No, I agree. I don't.
Have an odd spot
don't,
to try and do
don't
that.
Don't call a goddamn soul. The hell with it. Let me just say, getting this call from me, from you, I mean, I haven't heard from any cabinet officer except Weinberger an hour afterwards. And thank God, and no staff member.
Well, now when I called, the board said they were instructed not to put any calls through. So
the hell with that. I told them to put all the calls through.
Well, that may be why you haven't gotten them, though, because that's
all right.
What you told me.
I'll change it.
Right.
Fine, but God bless you, boy.
Okay.
God bless you. I love you, as you know.
Okay.
Like my brother.
And we'll
all right, boy.
On and up from
keep the faith.
Right.
Right. Yeah, Nixon going down in flames, and I think he'd had a little too much to drink. And talking to Haldeman, who ultimately went to jail for Nixon, as I recall, if my recollection of Watergate is correct. Talking about how the only guy who called him was Caspar Weinberger, who, as I recall, went to jail or was indicted during the Reagan administration. Anyhow, I thought that was that. You know, it's like, okay, we heard his treason. So, which, and just to wrap up the Vietnam thing, this is what Martin Luther King had to say about Vietnam. And you know, Martin Luther King, say what? No, he's not going to swear, I promise. Here we go.
The time has come for America to hear the truth about this tragic war. I've chosen to preach about the war in Vietnam today because I agree with Dante that the hottest places in hell are reserved for those who, in a period of moral crisis, maintain their neutrality. There comes a time when silence is betrayal. The truth of these words is beyond doubt, but the mission to which they call us is the most difficult one. Even when pressed by the demands of inner truth, men do not easily assume the task of opposing their government's policy, especially in time of war. Nor does the human spirit move without great difficulty against all the apathy of conformist thought within one's own bosom.
See, now this is Martin Luther King speaking out very, very loudly against the Vietnam War, something that you're not going to hear on Fox News. You're not going to hear basically in the mainstream media. Oh, Martin Luther King was fighting for the right of black people to sit at white counters, at lunch counters with white people and so on. No, no, no. I mean, yeah, of course there was that, but he was also very strongly opposed to the war in Vietnam. He was just totally in favor of the right to organize for collective bargaining and for unionization. And we talked when Nelson Mandela died about how they're going to turn him into, you know, another, you know, Saint Mandela, who another two-dimensional character, without remembering that this guy had been literally a terrorist. He had signed up for, yes, let's go blow up some buildings, let's go kill some people. That's what it's going to take to bring down this regime, the apartheid regime in South Africa, which was essentially a Nazi regime. I mean, you look at how the apartheid government was running. Your papers, please. Restricted to certain areas. And using African-Americans, or, you know, black Africans, for labor so that they could export goods. And you had American companies investing in the country because, hey, it's cheap labor.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So, I you know, it's like, not only do we need to remember the crimes of Nixon, we need to remember the noble gestures of people like MLK. Welcome back. 28 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Boy, that lead story in the Financial Times right now, world markets brace for deck taper. As in, presumably, December taper, or maybe deck is 10 in Latin, isn't it? But then the subhead says, clock runs down on 5 years of cheap capital. So that would be sink? No, that's whatever. I don't remember Latin for, yeah. I can do it in Spanish, you know, one of those tres, or Japanese, Ichinisan, yeah. Eins, zwei, drei, vier. Anyway, Echodstein, Shalosh, Arba, Hamesh. But world markets brace for deck taper. And basically what they're saying is that the whole world economy is being held together by the Fed pouring $85 billion a month into our banks. Really? That's not good. So anyway, I've been sharing these tapes with you, these little clips. And I just, there's a couple more, and this is apropos of the conversation that we just had with Malcolm Out Loud, who is sending out press releases going, oh, my God, there's a war on Christmas, and then comes on a radio show and says, hey, it's all good. And this is Frank Zappa on the Crossfire show with Robert Novak, who has since passed on, but they both passed on. Frank Zappa died. Didn't he die of, like, prostate cancer or something? I don't remember exactly what it was, but and Bob Novak recently passed away. But this was during the Reagan administration. And Reagan was reaching out to the fundamentalist Christians a lot to hold together the Republicans' constituency. Keep in mind, the Reagan administration was the most corrupt administration in the history of the United States, arguably, at least if you want to do it based on the number of members, sitting members of the president's administration who were indicted or who were sent to prison. If that's your metric, the Reagan administration was the most corrupt in the history of the country. And here's and you know, part of that was, you know, all this pandering to the religious right and Ralph Reed. And, you know, now we know about Ralph Reed's involvement with Jack Abramoff and Tom DeLay and all this kind of stuff. But anyhow, here's Frank Zappa on Crossfire in the mid 1980s during the Reagan administration, talking about how this fundamental Christianity that allows religious symbology on public property and government property is leading us down the road toward fascism.
The biggest threat to America today is not communism. It's moving America toward a fascist theocracy. And everything that's happened during the Reagan administration is steering us right down that pipe.
Oh, Mr. Zappa, do you really think? I mean, all kidding aside, in this country, with the permissiveness that we are moving toward a fascist theocracy, anything goes.
You bet we are, but...
You know, I mean, do you think things like this would ever
have
been permitted?
Give me that famous smile again.
When we were kids, you're about my age, maybe
I'm
a little 45. Younger. Well, I'm 55. Do you think when I was a kid that they would permit songs like that to be sold? I mean, permissiveness is the game. I mean, you're not really serious if you're saying we're going toward a fascist theocracy.
That's right, we are.
Wait a minute.
In what way? Give me one example.
One example of a fascist theocracy.
When you have a government that prefers a certain moral code mm-hmm. derived from a certain religion, and that moral code turns into legislation to suit certain religious point of view, and if that code right. happens to be very, very right-wing, almost toward the till of the Hun...
Well, then you are an anarchist. Every form of civil government is based on some kind of morality, Frank.
Morality in terms of behavior, not in terms of theology.
There you go. Frank's the one and only. The amazing Frank Zappa. So which brings us, you know, to the modern era and the modern, like the Bush presidency, for example. Where did it go? Here's Jim Jeffords. This is the senator from Vermont, the Republican senator from Vermont on Meet the Press or Face the Nation, one of those shows. Talking about during the Bush presidency, while he's in office, while he's a Republican senator, talking about why Bush went to war in Iraq.
But does the situation now in Iraq essentially show that he made the right decision?
I don't believe so. I was against it at the beginning, and I'm still against invading Iraq. I think it's created huge problems. I feel that we... should never have gone in there. I think it was all done to get oil. I think that that's the end result is going to be some oil agreement and to the loss of life that we had and to the cost of it was to me just a re-election move, and they're going to try to live off it and probably start another war. Wouldn't be surprised next year, probably in Iran.
Do you think that's likely?
Well, I probably shouldn't even talk on it. I just feel so bitter about the thinking that's gone on behind them and the reasons they go to war and went to war. But I feel very strongly that they're looking ahead and that there'll be an opportunity to go into Iran and try to get their son elected president. I don't know, but to do it each time they. When I have a new president, I'm very, very, yes. Oh, well, I better be quiet.
At that point, Jim Jeffords censors himself and shortly thereafter left the Republican Party. And I was living in Vermont when that happened, and there were bumper stickers all over the state that said, thank you, Jim. Right? I mean, like everybody. All of a sudden, there's this explosion of bumper stickers and yard signs and things, thank you, Jim, when he left the Republican Party. And I think that it affected the ability of the Republicans to legislate. It might have moved the Senate Democratic for a while. I'd have to go back and look at the era and the time. And then, you know, from that time, John Yoo was asked. Now, John Yoo was, you know, he was Bush's advisor. He's now a professor at the University of California at Berkeley, I believe, a law professor. I think he's a war criminal. He was asked because he advised George Bush that torture was acceptable. And in fact, here he is asked, is it acceptable to crush the testicles of a child in front of his father as a technique to interrogate the father, to get the father to talk? John Yoo.
If the president deems that he's got, including by crushing.
Let me start this over again.
If the president deems that he's got to torture somebody, including by crushing the testicles of the person's child, there is no law that can stop that.
No.
And also no law by Congress. That's what you wrote in the August 2002 memo.
I think it depends on why the president thinks he needs to do that.
Sorry? It depends on why the president thinks he needs to do that. But you wrote this in your memo. And then, you know, when he says there's no treaty that stops that. Well, there's no law that stops that. That's John Yoo. Now, meanwhile, this is what Jack Murtha, who fought in World War II, had to say, or maybe fought in Vietnam. I don't remember. Anyhow, Jack Murtha, who was a decorated veteran, what he had to say about Dick Cheney and George Bush, particularly Dick Cheney, getting us into these wars.
I like guys who've never been there to criticize us who've been there. I like that. I like guys who've got five deferments and never been there and send people to war and then don't like to hear suggestions about what need to be done.
Right, right. He's talking about Cheney. And then, you know, what Republicans used to be all about. In 1984... John Glenn actually ran for president. Now, this is a Republican running against a sitting Republican. He was running against Ronald Reagan in the primary. And here's John Glenn.
My real question is, as a military person, are you likely to get us into more combat, into more wars?
This is Ned.
Tell me what we can expect from your background and how you will handle those kinds of things.
No, I'll tell you this. I think as a military person, I am less likely. And let me tell you why. I have a military background, as I said, 23 years in the Marine Corps. I've been there. I've been shot at myself. My plane was hit on 12 different occasions. I know the terrors of war firsthand. I know what it's like to come back from a mission and sit down and have to write a next of kin letter to people I knew in the States, friends. Your husband isn't coming home. Your father is not coming home. I know what that's like. And that sears your soul, I can tell you that. I don't want to see combat ever visited again on anybody if we can possibly prevent it. And nobody is going to negotiate any harder for peace than I will.
John Glenn for president. Leadership for the future.
This is an ad. And, you know, it really reminds me of the Eisenhower for president ads. Let me see if I can grab one really quickly and play it for you. Here we go.
He has met Europe's leaders, has got them working with us. Elect the number one man for the number one job of our time. November 4th, vote for peace. Vote for Eisenhower. A paid film.
So this is, you know, Republicans. Now, when John Glenn was running in 84, he was basically running against Reagan's invasion of Grenada and you know, saber rattling. And then, you know, when Eisenhower was running, he was running against Harry Truman's war in Korea. And
vote for peace. Vote for Eisenhower. A paid film.
So back in the day, oh, John Glenn was a Democrat. You're right. John Glenn was a Democrat. I'm very, very sorry. I got it wrong. John Glenn was a Democrat, and he was running in 84 in the Democratic primary to go against Reagan. Thank you. Somebody called and corrected me. Thank you for that. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
You know, it's funny, as I was saying it, I was thinking, John, you know, I don't think Reagan was primary in 84, so where did John Glenn... But yeah, I was wrong. Now you know. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Jared, listening on WBAI in Comic, New York. Hey, Jared, what's up?
How you doing, Tom?
Fine. What's on your mind?
First time caller. Love your show.
Thank you.
I just wanted to talk about the Santa Claus debacle.
Mm-hmm.
I actually was really inspired by the FDR speech that you brought up last week in your program, and I think it actually speaks very well to the Santa Claus thing, where it said there will be powers that be that intentionally are looking to break apart the American spirit, to break apart the American people. And although I do believe there still is racism in America, I think Fox News is suddenly interested in bringing that issue to the table, and that they genuinely care about bringing some sort of solution or some sort of thought process to the people's minds? Probably not. I would use your own source material and say that I think this is an example of they are rebel rousing. They are trying to divide the people, not because the issue isn't real, but because they just found a very clever way to do it.
I think it's entirely possible in that segment that Megyn Kelly did that her producer was too cute by half. She had a producer who had read a piece by a relatively unknown blogger not a big name, right? Not a major name in America, and said, okay, this is an interesting take. Let's have a conversation about it. And they just didn't expect Megyn Kelly to come out and say, but Santa Claus was white, kids. I mean, they just, the producer didn't expect his own talent to say something that stupid. And
of course, I would probably agree with that.
So anyway, I think it was.
And then it was just continually subsequently brought up in programs after that. And I forget his name right now.
Bill O'Reilly last night. Now it's the constant, we never make a mistake. It's the Republican refrain, never admit a mistake.
Right. And so I just thought, at least the last caller was correct in that I didn't think it was brought up to or defended in a way. Just I kind of believe it was following this whole, let's drum up the most personal issues that Americans have today and keep their eyes off of what's really going on, like some of the stuff you brought up in the program today with the failures of the economy and everything else like that. So I just, that was my contribution, just wanted to say that.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I think you're absolutely right. Thank you for the comment, Jared. Thanks for listening to WBAI. Johnny in Lamarck, Texas. Johnny, got a minute to the break. What's up?
Good afternoon, Tom. Hey, two things about Malcolm, your guest. Did you notice how contradictory he was when he started out? The very first thing he did, you could almost see it in his body language if he were there for you to look at. But the way he asked you, or he opened with Merry Christmas with a certain sarcastic tone in his voice, he was almost goading you into saying, well, Merry Christmas and or Happy Holidays to you.
Right.
He was just dying for you to do that, and you didn't lead him down that path, so thanks for that.
You're welcome.
And promise me that you'll have him back if and when Jon Stewart shows a birth certificate revealing both Santa Claus and Mrs. Claus are half Latina.
Okay, you got it, Johnny. Thanks a lot for the call. I'm inclined not to have him back. I don't mind when people come on the program and argue their actual convictions, but when somebody comes on and says something completely different from what their news release says, just because they want to get press time, air time, I got a problem with that. We'll be back 10 minutes before the hour. Welcome back 10 minutes before the hour. And Jason in Washington, D.C., calling from the Ronald Reagan Republican building.
No, I'm a libertarian, so I don't have any association.
Okay, from Rand
but
Paul's office.
Whenever we have any discussion about presidents and stuff like that, I think it's important to talk about, let's call him Lyndon Landslide. How did he get there? This is the guy that was got into the Senate by rigging an election. 6 days after his election for the Senate, mysteriously a box shows up with 203 votes, of which 202 got him elected to the Senate. And it wasn't determined until a court case back in 1977 that it was admitted that there was vote rigging, and that's how Johnson got into the Senate.
Yeah. Well, there's a book called The Texan Looks at Lyndon, in which the author is even suggesting that Lyndon had back when he was running for statewide office that he had a guy killed. You know, there's a lot of conspiracy theories around a lot of politicians, but
I think we need to have an even hand when we start talking about politicians. We also have to know about when Kennedy was first going for Congress, how his father found the person that was going to be the biggest threat to Kennedy running, and he got a person with the exact same name to run so that it would split the vote because his son would be the seat during the primary.
Slick. Sort of like which president was it that was looking at? Was it Nixon who was looking at Ed Muskie, and he didn't want Muskie, he wanted Dukakis. Who did Dukakis end up running against? I think it was Bush the Elder. Yeah, it was Bush the Elder.
I mean, politics is a dirty business, but I think what happens is when we start to try to make it.
But they got they got Ed Muskie out by sending one of the Watergate guys up to put LSD in his coffee, and so he ends up on the back of his flatbed truck crying about his wife. I don't disagree that a lot of these politicians are corrupt and strange people, but when they're running for president and they commit treason, I can give you two examples of Republicans, and I can prove it, who committed treason to become president of the United States, and one who was, I would say knocking 80,000 African Americans off the voting rolls for no good reason is just before an election is at the very least a crime. So one who came to power by a crime. Can you give me a Democrat who became president of the United States that way?
Look, I'm not a defender of Republicans or Democrats. What I'm trying to do is just say that the system itself is corrupt across the board.
Okay,
and
so
I'm trying to make it seem like it's one side.
So if we're I think it is one side. I think that the Republicans are far more corrupt than the Democrats.
Did the unified budget, and he was the first one that started robbing Social Security, right? We want to highlight that fact.
What are you talking about?
It's guns and. The unified budget that
I missed the first part of what you're saying. Who are you talking about?
Well, I'm saying Lyndon Johnson. You know, when we want to talk about, who's the first person that went through the Social Security Trust Fund? Who's the guy that started?
There was no Social Security Trust Fund when Lyndon Johnson was president. The Social Security Trust Fund was created during the Reagan administration in 82 as a way of allowing baby boomers
so that he could balance his budget. Guns and butter. Johnson couldn't afford it. This is when we start having the fact that the gold reserves in the country start releasing them.
Jason, you're straining at a gnat. I mean, the fact of the matter is that, Social Security did run in the red a couple of years, but Social Security was and still is part of the general fund. And, this is what Al Gore was, as you recall, campaigning on. Separate Social Security from the general fund. But that didn't kill Social Security. And the Social Security Trust Fund never existed until 82. And that was it was put into place so that the baby boomers could be the first generation of Americans to be double taxed, to not only pay for the retirement of their parents, but also to pay for their own retirement through their working years, which they did through the 80s and the 90s and the 2000, the aughts now. That's why Reagan doubled the Social Security tax was so that the baby boomers would pay for their own retirement. That has, I don't see how you hit Lyndon Johnson on that. I opposed Lyndon Johnson in the war and I opposed his budget shenanigans. But, so what? That does not rise to the level of treason. Will you agree with me, Jason? If you're taking the position that both parties are corrupt and both parties have been corrupted, would you agree with me that they have been corrupted by money?
Yes and no. I think power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. I think the quest for power sometimes will actually overrule money.
I don't disagree, but isn't money the principal way that people flex power in the United States right now?
Well, I don't know. When Obama is supposed to be a constitutional scholar. He's the one in the White House. And we've got Eric Holder in the Justice Department, and they don't understand the level of Fourth Amendment violations that are going on.
Well, this was going on during the Bush administration, too. You could say the same thing of Bush and Alberto Gonzalez.
Let's stick with them. They got elected. Now they're in charge. They should have eliminated it 4 or 5 years ago when they realized the shenanigans that were going on, yes or no?
Jason, you're going step by step for the things on which we may agree. My point, and I'm trying to find out if we agree on this.
For money.
Will you?
Okay.
Yeah. Maybe not, because 70% of the NSA's budget is privatized right now. So you've got huge defense contractors. Booz Allen Hamilton, for example, where Ed Snowden worked, which was owned by the Carlyle Group, which was owned in part by the Bin Laden family. This is a for-profit corporation. 70% of the NSA's budget is for-profit corporations. Those for-profit corporations are pouring money back into the pockets of Republican and Democratic politicians, possibly including the president. Who knows? So will you join me in calling for a constitutional amendment to reverse the Supreme Court doctrine that money is protected under the First Amendment as speech and that corporations are protected under the 14th Amendment as persons being wrong?
Well, here we are. A corporation is not a person. So how about if I'm driving
down
the highway and I've got a trust document with me that's a corporation, do I get to drive in the HOV lane?
Well, that's what
I should be able to.
Yeah, well, that's what my friend Jonathan tested that. He went out and he got himself arrested. He got a ticket in the HOV lane with corporation papers in his.
Come out.
Yeah. Okay. Jason, thanks for the call. Good talking with you. Coming up tomorrow, all the news and information you won't hear on the corporate-owned news media, along with your calls right here on the Tom Hartman Program. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It genuinely does begin with you. You got to get involved, you know. Get out there and occupy something. Like movetoamend.org or pdamerica.org or any... I mean, there's a bunch of great organizations. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman Program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. Edison Factor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartman.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartman.com. Thank you.